Well, hello, everybody. Today, I'd like to welcome Daniel Gulotta to the show. Daniel is a PhD candidate in American religious history at Stanford University and the host of the Age of Jackson podcast. He received his master's degree in the history of Christianity from Yale University Divinity School. His current research is focused on how religious politics shaped the rise of Andrew Jackson and the birth of the second party system. He has written for The Washington Post, The Bulwark, National Review, and the Claremont Review of Books. Now, for those of you listening down the line, we are today on the eve of the election of 2020. Since Daniel and I discussed the upcoming election, the candidates, and the contentions surrounding today's political discourse in comparison with that of the 1830s and 40s, I think it's probably a good idea to make note of the context. So before we get rolling, let me implore you to use your better judgment and go to theroguehistorian.com and subscribe to this show. And while you're at it, please leave a rating and a comment. You'll be doing the right thing. Okay, let's welcome Daniel to the show. Let's do it. All right. Daniel, welcome to the show, man. It's great to have you on.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. Now, I've been listening to your show with great enthusiasm and kind of following your path as you move along here. You are a PhD student at Stanford who is now ABD. Is that correct?
That is correct. Praise God. Yes, ABD.
Glory, hallelujah. Yes. Tell us what ABD means for those of us who haven't had the pleasure of going through graduate school.
So ABD for the uninitiated means all but dissertation. So if you meet someone who's a candidate, a PhD candidate, it means they've done their classes, they've done their coursework, they've passed these Herculean exams where they have to wade through the mire of over 200 years of historiography sometimes, maybe even worse, depending their subfield. So they've gone through the courses, they've done the exams, they've defended a prospectus, which is basically your pitch for how you're going to make your mark, and you're unleashed upon the world. You have the freedom to finally do what you want to do, basically.
To inflict all of this onto the unsuspecting public, as it were. You kind of triggered me a little bit. I remember my qualifying exams were something else at the University of Virginia. Just sitting there, and just remember that group of people just sort of coming down on you.
I did mine via Zoom, which was an interesting experience.
Oh yeah, I'll bet.
Because I did it just as I was coming back. I gave a lecture in Washington State in Forks, fun fact, where Twilight is based. I was at a community college there, and that's just when we were first getting the rumblings of COVID. Mm-hmm. We really didn't know how big of a deal it was going to be. And then Stanford kind of was starting like, well, like, let's avoid campus, blah, blah, blah. But within, on the direct horizon, was my qualifying exam. So my supervisors and I were like, well, should we do it? What should we do? So we decided to do it via Zoom. And that was a very interesting experience.
Yeah. Now we're all used to it though. I mean, you know, early days, I remember teaching my classes was really weird. It was just it was a hard thing to work around, but now we got it. And I think everybody's kind of fallen into, you know, staring. All of our relationships are through little 2-inch boxes now.
Well, I didn't do the whole, like, you know, if there was a question I stumbled on, oh, you're breaking up. Like,
yeah. So you study religion during the era of Jacksonian democracy. And my initial questions for you are, why religion? Why this period in particular? And do you ever tire of the, oh my God, you're studying a bunch of old dead white guys eye roll?
Well, it depends the audience for the last question. These are like sort of successively bigger than smaller questions. So I'll start with the big question first. Why religion? I've been fascinated with religion ever since I was about 9-10 years old. Just to reveal my age, 9/11 had a very big impact on me when I was a boy, because I started to learn about this thing called Islam and the idea of a jihad and things like that. And the idea that this kind of like, what do you mean that by doing this act of violence, they'll end up in paradise? That was kind of like crazy to me. So I did some research into Islam, and that led me like, well, I think I'm Catholic. Like, that's what it says on my birth certificate. I was baptized as a baby. So what does that even mean? Mm-hmm. So I started to study Catholicism. And it's like, well, hold on. Like, what's the difference between us and the Baptists down the road? So one thing led to another, and I just got sucked into it. And to make it even worse or better, I was a giant nerd. So I was used to the worlds of C.S. Lewis, J.R. Tolkien. My father was obsessed with Greco-Roman mythology. So the ideas of gods and goddesses and divinities, demigods, was kind of, I was used to that stuff with video games and fantasy novels. So all of that kind of made the perfect chemical mix to get into religion. I was actually in training to be a priest for a while, but that's a whole other story. So that's kind of like, originally my background is in the ancient world. So to get to your second question of what got me into American history, the answer is kind of twofold. One, I started dating an American. My wife, then girlfriend, is from Kansas, and I figured I was dating an American, so I should learn about American history. And I just got really bit. I got bit by the bug pretty crazily. So I read your standard like Ron Chero stuff and David McCullough. This was when I was in my early 20s. And one thing led to another. I just got bit by the American history bug, and the two fused in Mormonism. I read Joseph Smith's I read the biography of Joseph Smith by Richard Bushman, a very famous historian of early America and of early Mormonism. And I just loved that book. And eventually I found my way to Daniel Walker Howe's What Hath God Wrought. And that really, just the Jacksonian period became this kind of wonderland for me. Because with religion, there's so much religious creativity and experimentation and fascination and weirdos, to put it bluntly, out there in that time period. And I just really, really, really got hooked by it. But eventually Jackson himself kind of drew me to him, because I would read What Hath God Wrought, and then I would read Rise of American Democracy or American Lion, you know, just reading or even just passing phrases where there could be something very laudatory, very, maybe not praiseworthy. Nothing was like as praiseworthy as like the earlier stuff from, you know, the early 20th century or the late 19th century. But even just like, you know, Jackson symbolized the common man entering into politics. It's like, oh, that's really interesting. But then I would read another book and it's like Jackson unleashed the forces of white supremacy in a way that had never been experienced before. It's like, oh geez. Like, so it was kind of like, how can this guy represent both of these things? And the more I got into him, the more I saw diversity and conflict in the scholarship. And beyond that, just like, not so much his biography, but just the meaning, like what did Andrew Jackson mean? And that just hooked me immediately. Mm-hmm. And to make it all the better, is in English. So coming from the ancient world, everything being in Latin and Greek or Coptic, I just really struggled with ancient languages. And to make it even worse, there were like, if you study the ancient world, there's like seven sources, and it's the seven same sources over again. I mean, that's unfair. That's a caricature. But, you know, it's like you got the New Testament, you got Tacitus, you got Pliny. Maybe you'll get lucky and there'll be some graffiti that rocks up somewhere. But it's really, really, you know, how many more Gospel of Mark commentaries do there need to be? But then when I came to the modern period, it was just an embarrassment of riches with newspapers and diaries and sermons, letters all over the place, you know, multi-volume papers projects about presidents, as well as, you know, random farmers who kept every detail down of their lives. So it was just this, and I could read it all, although the handwriting quality differed. But being able to just read it was just such, it sparked my imagination. Jeremy, what was the third question? Oh, and do I get sick of the eye rolling?
Yeah.
Well, yes and no. I've learned to kind of just deal with it, because I think everybody gets eye rolls depending what they study and who they talk to. Mm-hmm. So there could be some people, it's like, really, like another book on Frederick Douglass, like really, do I really care about the milkmaids during the Civil War eye roll? Mm-hmm. Really, another book about Teddy Roosevelt? So I think like you're going to get eye rolls no matter who you talk to. It just depends who you talk to. So I've learned just to lean into it. And some scholars, I used to work in sales and I'm a bit extroverted. So I enjoy the sales pitch. I enjoy like, no, this is why my research matters. And this is why it's going to affect your research. Or like, yeah, you don't have to read it. Go away.
Have you ever, you mentioned, you know, the abundance of sources. Do you ever find that you are overwhelmed by the amount? Cause this is something that I, you know, it's funny. We have a somewhat of a similar background. I thought about going into, the classics as well. I studied Latin in college and I thought about studying, the Roman Republic. I found interesting, but you know, I ran up against some of the same issues that you did. And finally, really, my first love was Civil War history and American history during that particular period, Civil War and Reconstruction. So I went back to my first love, and then I found, of course, I can read everything. And there is an abundance of resources. But at the same time, that's both a blessing and a curse. I found that, you know, there's so much. When do you say, okay, that's, I've got enough, and begin to write something?
Oh, that's a really good question. And that's a good question for, I think, senior scholars and grad students or even undergrads to kind of think about. I think that in a sort of artistic way, you know, the perfect is the enemy of the done or the good. Mm-hmm. So there has to be some kind of controlling impulse at some point. The question, as you put it quite rightfully, is when does that emerge? And I think it depends the question you're asking. So if you're asking about what was life like for Jews in 19th century Charleston, well, it's like, okay, I'm going to study Jews. I'm going to study Charleston. Maybe I'll expand, you know, to South Carolina a little bit for more context, but that might help me. But then if you're going to expand the question, like what was like life for Jews in the entire United States, a bigger question demands a bigger archive to be explored. Mm-hmm. So something I learned from Harry Stout at Yale, where I did my master's, was you can have scaling questions. You can have one question that's really small, but that can lead you to another one. And you can use those questions to help pinpoint what matters and what's interesting and what can evolve. So when you're writing a journal article, like right now I'm working on religion and the Creek War. And that's a, you know, it's got a well-defined fence around it, but I'm trying to think within like, how do I write a journal article chapter for my dissertation out of this? And it's like, okay, when did the revivals hit Kentucky, Nashville, Alabama, like when did they hit that area? Let's figure that out. Okay, who are the major players? Okay, this is who they are. Why do they matter? So you can kind of use little questions to lead you and help shape you. I found that to be a helpful tactic.
Let's talk about podcasting. You and I both host podcasts quite clearly. I wanted to have you on the show to talk about podcasting. I think podcasting is a really, really interesting format, especially these days when so many people are turning to various forms of media in our daily lives. I've become a big fan of your show, The Age of Andrew Jackson. Rather enjoyed it most recently. I've listened to the episodes featuring Richard Ellis and Christopher Leahy on John Tyler, and Ellis is on the election of 1840. And I also liked Paul Polgar's show on the first abolition movement, which I found very enjoyable. So let me ask you, why did you get into podcasting? What purpose does it serve you personally? Mm-hmm. And do you think that this is an effective way to disseminate academic history to a broader audience?
Yeah, I appreciate that you said, personally, because I think there are personal elements that I speak quite freely about, and some people might find it kind of, kind of murky to talk about it. But yeah, like this podcast does have benefits for me personally. And I make no bones about that. It's kind of like people who write opinion columns. for a major outlet like the Washington Post is made by history. Like, yeah, like on the one hand, you're doing a public service, you're disseminating knowledge, you're helping a wider audience come into contact with interesting historical details and maybe lessons for the present. But it also raises your profile. It also gets you a badge of approval from the Washington Post. Like, once again, like coming from a sales background, I think I'm a bit okay with this type of stuff. But some academics I've encountered don't want to acknowledge this type of stuff. But yeah, I'm a bleeding heart capitalist, so I can live with it. But no, I'll to get you know, to stop horsing around. I decided to start a podcast for multiple reasons. One, because I really enjoyed the format myself. I really enjoyed listening to podcasts of book review, you know, book interviews, political punditry, but also most of all historical dissemination, particularly Liz Covart's Ben Franklin's World, I found really enjoyable and informative. And as someone who had come to the United States several years ago, her podcast was a great way to learn about early America, and several other podcasts as well were just really helpful tools. So a part of me was like, oh, I could do that. It's the classic, you read a book and it's like, oh, I could write a book like that. So yeah, I listened to podcasts I liked and I thought I could do it. But beyond that, I also, there was a twofold thing. One of the things that really irritated me was my favorite time period, the Jacksonian antebellum era, was often left out in these podcasts. If it was like a broad podcast on United States history, maybe I would get lucky and there would be a guest who had written a book on it. But often or not, I had to kind of seek it out myself. And as many antebellum scholars will tell you, we kind of feel left out. If you go to a bookstore, you see, you know, there's a wonderful section for like revolution and founding. And then you look your eyes over and it says Civil War. Yes, it's like, right. stuff happened in the middle.
Yes, I heard. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So a part of me was like, wow, like I could own the market, as it were, if I inserted myself in here. I could really raise my profile and raise other people's profiles. The other part was, being a bit of an extrovert, I wasn't afraid to get into this. I wasn't afraid to stick my neck out. But beyond that, I'm sure you don't need to be told, but your listeners might be interested or may not or be aware of this. Academia is really, really competitive. And I thought like, well, this might be a way to kind of put a gold star on my profile if I could make a successful podcast. Not only would I help the public and expose people and scholars, even I found that lots of scholars listen to my podcast and it's like, oh, I didn't even know about this book existing, which is really always gratifying. But just being able to like, oh, you know, not only is Daniel hopefully a good scholar and a good teacher, he also has this podcast. Mm-hmm. That's something I have warned people, like, you're never going to make your net. No one will give you a job in the academy because you're a podcaster. But if it's the cherry on top, it definitely might be something that could help you, although it could hurt you as well. But that's, we can talk about that as well.
I mean, I suppose it depends on what you say.
Right.
Podcast, it could rub some people the wrong way, but I mean, you know, we live in a world where, you know, we're all big kids now. And I think we should be able to handle that. Although sometimes I feel that people are overly sensitive to some things and they get their noses bent out of shape over stuff very easily.
Well, it depends the format. I do an interview style and often my interview style is, even though I'm working on a PhD and I consider myself with some expertise in this field, often because I want to meet a general audience, I have to play dumb often. Like, I know what the War of 1812 was about, but my listeners may not. Mm-hmm. And I personally, though, one of the things that's really helpful with that format is I get to hear different answers from experts who can help me as well. So like when I'm teaching about the War of 1812, I can ask an expert on the War of 1812 and get it dissimilated in a way that's like, oh, that's so like, that's so good. I need to write this down for my own teaching. And other high school teachers and professors have told me the same sort of thing. So I think that's been one of the benefits as well. But beyond that, it's, it being in the more interview style rather than the sort of opinion style or round table, similar to what the Junto cast does, mm-hmm. or the Junto cast, the Whiskey Rebellion, where they're much more free flowing and they're experts talking amongst other experts. Mm-hmm. I decided to go the more book a week route as well. So there are all different styles of podcast. And I found myself that I figured the one that would be best for me and my personality would be the interview style.
Yeah. You know, you've mentioned something that I think is really, really important. It's something that I've thought about a lot as I, you know, listen to different kinds of podcasting, as teachers can really get a lot out of these things, especially, you know, I mean, for my U.S. history survey course, for example, I mean, my area of expertise is the latter third of the 19th century. And so, I mean, I studied the antebellum period, of course, and I can sort of come to that dance. But when it gets down to, you know, distilling the historiography, when it gets down to distilling, you know, other important works into, you know, a few minutes for a single class, podcasting is extraordinarily helpful. I've found that I've pulled over to my car to write things down that I've heard people say, and even on your show, you know, just recently I was thinking about this because we're getting closer and closer to the antebellum period. And I'm starting to think about what to assign at this point and what to talk about in classes because of, you know, podcasting allows us to bring in scholars who are offering new things to an old subject in ways to rethink them. And this is why I started the podcast, because I want to talk to people from all different walks of life. Now, you know, you mentioned there are different formats. I kind of take a much broader, you know, cast a much broader net, and I'll talk to anybody about anything in United States history, just because I want to, you know, hear what's new and what's going on. And it really helps, you know, kind of me broaden my understanding of what's happening. Let me ask you this. I've been very pleased. I've been very fortunate in that I have had lots and lots of engagement with well-informed members of the public, people who are not academics, but they're well-read and they are interested in talking about this stuff. But on the other hand, I have also run across a lot of people who I would guess say either have very little or entirely lack of historical consciousness. And I think that it's crucial that, you know, as, you know, American citizens, we understand our country. We understand what's going on here. We understand our history. Why do you think, and I'm just going to go ahead and go on a limb here and say you probably agree that it's important that we study our history. Why is it that you think we do? Why is it you think it's important that we understand our history?
I mean, it's kind of cliche, the whole, mm-hmm. you know, those who don't learn history are doomed to repeat it. Yeah, it's a cliche for a reason. Mm-hmm. I mean, it depends. History applies to so many different parts of our lives, and it doesn't always apply in the same way. Some of these are lessons we can learn so we don't make mistakes. Sometimes I think history is valuable because it can learn us appreciation. Like when people say like, this is the worst of all times we've ever been in, it's like, well, hold on, like things have actually been a lot worse. So maybe we can be grateful. But on the flip side, when we do experience dark moments, we can see that these dark moments exist in a continuum, that there's an evolution, that there's a mutation, when it comes to racism in this country, you can draw jagged lines between slavery, Jim Crow, and racial discrimination today. And these things exist. These things exist in a permeation in our history. So history applies to almost every part of our lives, but it doesn't apply in the same way. And I think that's one of the problems. I think some people just want to say history matters. But I think different kinds of history matters at different moments to different people and in different ways. Mm-hmm.
You touched on something that I was going to ask you anyway. I mean, I turn on the 24-hour cable news channels and I hear these guys on there talking about and making claims that we have never been more divided as a nation than we are today. Now, as a person who studies the American Civil War, I automatically go, well, actually, you know,
right.
You know, and so I was wondering what your thoughts on this. Do you see any parallels between 21st century political polarization and the political contentions of the 1830s and the 1840s?
I mean, I can't help but do it. It's kind of, it's in my bones to do it. It's funny you should mention it because, people are the campaign tactics. We've never seen smear attacks like this. And then come on, like 1824 and 1828 are ruthless. But then Gordon Wood will come up and say, come on, 1800 is like way worse. So people can always push us back further in terms of some kind of evolution. But in terms of what I'm more interested in is, so I'm really interested in the American two-party system and how coalitions, alliances, and strange bedfellows get together, and how political ideologies and alliances and friendships and enemies change and mutate over time. And religion is a big part of that. The thesis I'm working on directly relates to the birth of the second party system and how religion clarifies some of the battle lines along with banking, Indian removal, slavery, things like that. And one of the things I'm really fascinated by is the reshuffling of the deck between the current day Republican Party and the current day Democratic Party, watching these new alliances form, watching these new friendships get formed, and these uneasy truces that I'm very eager to see how they play out. That's what reminds me more about. So for example, let's just say Joe Biden wins the presidency. Mm-hmm. And the question becomes, by what degree? Let's just say it's a very narrow victory. Does that mean Trumpism becomes a permanent part of the GOP? Well, let's just say he crushes. So does that mean the GOP has to reinvent itself again? Or does it go back to something else? Who will be there? Who will stay? Who will leave? Because there are these new voters who have never voted before. The famous Obama-Trump voters, let's just say they go back to Joe Biden. Do they stick with him or are they a tenuous part of this alliance? It looks like the Bernie Sanders wing is not happy with the Democratic mm-hmm. Party right now. Polling shows that they're eager to vote against Trump. So let's just say they win. What does the internal conflict look like? So those type of things, I see a lot of similarities between the internal conflicts of the Whig Party and the internal conflicts of the Jacksonian Party. So the coalitional stuff, that's the big thing. I always tell, as when people start to bemoan the two-party system, I always remind them that American politics is coalitional and people don't like that. People hate making deals with people. Well, I find it fascinating. In terms of other things I find similar, like it's hard not to find similarity between a lot of the talking about, wealth and land is a constant discussion in almost all of political history in the United States. Who has, the House of Want and the House of Have, to use George Bancroft's language. That's been a staple of our politics since the beginning. So it's hard not to see that. But it's always interesting to see like how different, in terms of like modern day politics summoning the American past, it's very interesting to see how the different parties use American history in different ways and things like that. So I know that's a long-winded answer, but yes, I do see parallels, but often not the parallels people want me to talk about, like is Trump like Jackson and all that, that type of stuff.
Mm-hmm. So. Well, that's actually one of the questions that I wanted to talk to you about, because that is something I think comes up all the time.
All the time.
It comes up all the time, and I wanted your thoughts on that. I mean, and normally I don't, I don't really talk about modern politics too much on this show, but from time to time I'll bring it up and say, what the hell? Trump did say in 2015, and I have, after a visit to the Hermitage, he said that his election most closely resembled that of Andrew Jackson, and that he was, quote, a fan, end quote, of Andrew Jackson. I'm not exactly sure what that means, but some people have drawn the comparisons between the two men, especially their populist rhetoric. And others have claimed that the comparison is kind of a thin between the two men. What are your thoughts on that?
Razor thin. Mm-hmm. I
Figured you were going that direction.
Yeah, but
I
yeah. So, if for people who are interested, if you go to National Review online, I wrote an article called "Donald Trump is no Andrew Jackson," and that was my response to a lot of this rhetoric. To put it simply, I mean, I can go for the list, but the easiest way to dismantle is Jackson was actually popular, and I'm not saying that to discredit Trump. That's just a fact that Trump narrowly won the Electoral College. He didn't win the popular vote. Jackson crushed the popular vote and the Electoral College. Jackson basically finds the power of democracy in the election of 1824, when he wins the popular vote and the majority of electoral votes, but not enough to be president, and it goes to the House of Representatives, and they choose John Quincy Adams over him. That's when he basically summons the forces of democracy. That, the Jacksonians, their creed is basically the majority is to govern. Trump doesn't have that whatsoever. Beyond that, there are other things we can talk about as well. The Jacksonians, now granted, this is white immigration, but the Jacksonians are much more open to immigration. They are seen as the party of immigrants much more in the Jacksonian period. They are rapid expansionists, not protectionists. They're much more laissez-faire capitalists. Definitely not when it comes to tariffs and things like that. So that, like, even on policy grounds, there's very little similarity. Where you could say there is a similarity is that Trump is as a polarizing figure as Jackson was. People loved to hate Andrew Jackson, and they loved him dearly, in a kind of mythic proportions. So there are some similarities between that. There are some similarities with the cult-like obsession of Jackson and Trump. But then again, you could say lots of, the cult of Obama, the cult of John F. Kennedy. So there's lots of presidents have these kind of polarizing personalities. If anything, though, I'm more intrigued that Trump might bear similarities between Zachary Taylor, but that's a whole another conversation.
Oh yeah, and how so? Because I'm actually interested now. How does
So this is not an argument original to me. It's been floated about by a few political scientists, and I'm kind of intrigued by it. That basically Taylor becomes the presidential nominee of the Whigs when they're at their weakest and most vulnerable. He's a celebrity who kind of hijacks the party per se. His nomination causes people to bolt the party because of his pro-slavery standards, which is the conscience Whigs turn away and leave, very similar to the Never Trump Republicans of the Bulwark, Bill Kristol, lots of the former Bush Reagan types. There's a giant internal conflict about what to do about Taylor, very similar to what you saw on the right with National Review, sort of soul searching about what to do with Taylor. Taylor doesn't commit to a lot of policy ideas. He kind of throws stuff out there and see what works. He's not a Whig in ideology at all, in many ways. Taylor is kind of erratic when it comes to the kind of Henry Clay American system. So Taylor kind of upends a lot of Whig orthodoxy. Well, Trump has upended a lot of Republican orthodoxy. So I'm happy to share in the show notes some of the articles for your if your listeners are interested. It's not a perfect analogy, as the saying goes, history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes.
It rhymes, yes.
Well, I think the rhymes between Taylor and Trump are better between Jackson and Trump.
Very interesting. Yeah, that sounds. I would like you to share those things, and I'll put them in the show notes for sure. Let's talk about literature. I would be very pleased for you to let me know what one book, if you could choose one book, that would help the general public get a
Oh boy.
handle on this very complex period of American history.
Oh boy. Okay.
You only get one.
Well,
I
okay.
do this.
So I would be remiss to say if you're going to study the age of Jackson, the Sean Lewentz, he's on my committee. I will be fully open. So Sean Lewentz's Rise of American Democracy from Jefferson to Lincoln is a masterstroke in writing about the politics of this period. So if you want to know about how we got the Democratic Party and the Whig Party, eventually the Republican Party, if you want to know about the conflicts that rocked the political world of this time period, that is the one to go for. If I can sneak in a second one, if you're more interested in culture and religion and things like that, then check out Daniel Walker Howe's What Hath God Wrought. And if you've got time, read both of them, because Lewentz's study is a much more pro-Jacksonian study and very down on the Whigs. And Howe's book is very anti-Jacksonian and very pro-Whigs. No. So if you've got time, read both of them. Sorry, the dogs are going crazy.
Oh, no, it's fine. I think barking dogs, and in my case, helicopters, because I live in Hollywood, flying over my house, give the show a new layer of authenticity as, you know, real people having a conversation. So I completely embrace barking dogs, crying babies, whatever you happen to have around. That's fine.
So yeah, so I would recommend reading both of those to kind of like, on the one hand, you'll just learn a ton, like audience, you'll learn so much from both of those books, but you'll kind of get into the same conundrum scholars get into. It's like, okay, like why are some historians more pro Whig and why are some more pro Democrat? Although these days, I think that issue is changing a little bit. But yeah, so those two, but I personally, I'm a hashtag team Lewentz myself.
Well, and I say also listen to your podcast. If you really want to get a handle on the stuff that's going on and, you know, antebellum Jacksonian politics, you know, from the 1820s through the 1850s and leading up into the Civil War, I would definitely have a listen because I have expanded my knowledge of this period and been thinking a lot more about it lately just because I've been listening to this during, you know, my drive to and from school every morning. And really my Amazon list is looking pretty heavy these days. And so, you know, I might have to get a second job or something to to pay for.
That's one of the best things about starting a podcast is you get books for free.
That's true. I get lots and lots of titles sent to me pretty much on the daily these days. And so so that is nice. What's next for yours? What do you have on the horizon for the podcast?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't know how much I should divulge. No.
Secrets.
No. There's definitely, now that I'm back in the saddle and I'm set up, we've got good internet again, thank goodness, things like that. And if you've been on Instagram or Twitter, you've seen my father-in-law built me a lovely working desk.
I've been following that story. It is nice to have someone.
Yeah, it's very nice.
House, right?
I'm very blessed. No, more interviews, of course, are coming up. So we're going to be talking about the Shawnee Prophets that will be coming up. There's a murder mystery in New York City involving an actress that should intrigue some listeners. Who else do I have? Definitely some more history of history episodes are in the works as well. At some point, I would also like to start getting into YouTube with 5-minute clips, sort of like crash course Jacksonian antebellum history. But that how feasible that is going to be difficult because now I'm in the thick of writing my thesis and hosting the podcast and applying for grants. So it's, you know, a lot on my plate right now. I don't know about you, but I keep signing up to do book reviews, which I probably should have.
I've done that. And I recently did a peer review for a journal as well. And that can be time consuming, you know? The YouTube thing is something that I did for a while, and I've stepped away from it, but I've been thinking about resurrecting my YouTube channel. I did this thing called Office Hours where I would take actual questions from my students, you know, and I would distill the answers down to, you know, a 3 to 5 minute video, but it's very labor intensive. So, yeah. You know, it takes, you know, to produce a good looking 3 to 4 minute video is the hits all the major points is actually kind of a you know.
Yeah. Getting the script right. I mean, just to use just those 3 minute, 5 minute video format that Vox does with the kind of the animations. Mm-hmm. Just trying to replicate something like that, but it that would require hiring people, which, you know, luckily my podcast does receive a little bit of funding from my amazing, amazing patrons and Patreon subscribers and a little bit of ad revenue, but that would be more like that. I could not do that. So it's one of those things where, I have grand plans and visions, but, in my own personal, the podcast is a priority, but my own research always comes first. Mm-hmm. So the main thing is time management, making sure that I've done my homework, I've done my research, I've done my primary source analysis and my thesis writing, so I can then make sure I have, but that's one of the good things about an interview style is I can kind of just go in and ask questions. So that definitely, you know, the editing is a little time consuming, but the more you edit, the kind of the easier it gets.
Yeah, no, it's something that comes. I mean, I don't do a lot of editing in my show, really. We just sort of a kind of a free form question answer kind of thing. And I'm interested to hear more of your history of history episodes. I recently started doing those too. I had, and I've only done one episode so far on this, but I want to address the works of some of the, you know, the bigger figures in American history. I just had Michael Haddam on from the Junto cast a few weeks ago, and we talked about Bernard Bailyn, which was a great conversation. You know, Bernard Bailyn says he's out of my area of expertise, but I read him in graduate school, as everyone does. And you know, he's an interesting dude. So
I was very blessed to be asked, the Bulwark, asked me to write an obituary about him, which, I did a deep dive onto newspapers.com and, in Playboy magazine of all places, I found Bernard Bailyn, which was kind of crazy. Huh. Yeah. It turns out that he was protested in the 80s. Yeah, he sort of, you know, once again, like people talking about echoes and, you know, cancel culture. And it's like, well, you know, Playboy's talking about cancel culture in 1980 something, which is kind of funny. Well, if you want someone to talk about my beloved Arthur M. Schlesinger Jr.'s Age of Jackson, I would love, like, I love that book. I know it's got its problems before I hear the groaning on the other end. but I agree with Sean LeWentz that we've underappreciated that book, I think, in recent years. We were so eager to dismantle it that now it's kind of like, I mean, I'm curious what it'd be like in your time period. It's one of those things where you hear so many caricatures about books. It's one of the reasons why I love doing the History of History episodes is that I hear like, the Frontier thesis is basically blah, 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 blah. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the caricature matches up perfectly, but there are other times where it's like, well, it's a little bit more nuanced than that. Like, and so going back and reading these like classic works has been a very interesting experience, you know, rather than just being told like, well, this is what, I mean, you're even starting to get that with Bailyn a little bit. You know, it's like, well, this is what ideological origins is all about. And, you know, and it's like, well, it's a little bit more complicated than that.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. But still, I mean, it's fun to go back. I always loved historiography, when I was in school, and that was like kind of my favorite thing to do. And I even have a class, you know, I teach high school, and I even have an advanced class for my high school seniors that we deal with historiography. And, they think that it's really fascinating, which is going to be cool. Cause they're going to be ahead of the curve when they get to college. Cause I didn't ever heard of this stuff, you know, by the time I got to college. And so,
well, historiography's got me down the arming America rabbit hole, and that's how I met Michael. So that whole, because I was in David Blight's class, and he made a comment about like arming America, and all of us were like, "What's that?" We'd never heard of the book, and he told us the story, and I went down to Yale's library and I borrowed it out. And then years later, I ended up interviewing him on the podcast. And that's like, if I had bucket loads of money, I'd love to do a kind of Making of a Murderer, Tiger King mini series documentary about arming America, like how that, what happened, what's it about that, like if I had a blank check, I would make that mini series about arming America.
I would watch it. That would be a great series. Very nice indeed. Do you ever get the feeling that there are, these days, everybody seems to be putting together a podcast. Do you get the feeling that we are being like saturated, that we're being overwhelmed with 9 million podcasts? And I'm saying this speaking as a podcaster, of course. And I said, oh, there's another one. You know, they're popping up left and right.
Yeah. I mean, like, look, yes, but you can say that with like so many different products. Mm-hmm. You know, to take a kind of market perspective, this happens, you know, we were saturated with smartphones, but now like the best have kind of risen to the top, and there's all these middling ones out there as well. Statistically speaking, like I did a deep dive into just the production of making podcasts, and most podcasters stop before 50 episodes. So if you can make it to 100 episodes, then you've probably got something consistent. So even though there are podcasting popping up all the time, that doesn't mean they're going to run the distance. Mm-hmm. The other problem is often I would say the vast majority of podcasts I see emerging, I mean, and this is not even in history. This is like, what differentiates you from somebody else? And somebody else's podcast. And why should I listen to you becomes the permanent question. So let's just say you wanted to start a political punditry podcast and you're just some rando, you know, some random grad student. Mm-hmm. So, well, why should I care? What expertise, what experience, what insights do you have that make you worth listening to? Now, if you're like a political analyst with 30 years of experience and you're a pollster with like degrees and stuff, like, you know, that's one of the things is like you can delineate between stuff. When it comes to history podcasts, it can be the same type of thing where you kind of just see history buffs, which is great, making these podcasts, but then some of them succeed and some of them don't. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I anybody who's interested in terms of the saturation question, I'm not too worried, because at the end of the day, I've got to worry about my own podcast first and foremost. So like if somebody created the Antebellum podcast or the Age of Henry Clay podcast, you know, maybe I'd be a little like, oh, like I got competition now. But like on the flip side, you know, the more the merrier. At the other hand, like I'm not going to begrudge anybody doing this type of thing. Yeah, I'm kind of just rambling. Yeah. I don't see it as a problem because of how aware I am of the sort of success to failure ratio. It doesn't really bother me. I'm more worried about me, I suppose.
Okay. Well, that makes perfect sense. Now I have one last question for you before I let you go. You end your shows with a James Baldwin quote. And I'm gonna give it right back to you here. American history is longer, larger, more various, more beautiful, and more terrible than anything anyone has ever said about it. And you ask your guests to meditate and reflect on that quote. And so I'm gonna turn it back to you and ask you to do the same.
You know, it's funny you should ask me this, because more recently, more and more people have been asking me to answer this question. I usually dodge it because I don't.
But now you're on the spot.
Yeah, I'm on the spot now. I'm not on my podcast. Look, I've basically agreed with 95% of my guests' answer to this question. Mm-hmm. And most people answer something like, to the effect of that the spirit of that Baldwin reflection is right, that American history is more beautiful than any book can fully contain, but it's also more terrible than any book or interview can or movie can ever depict. And there are, like I said at the very beginning of this podcast, I think there are different moments for different kinds of history. And to use Bernard Baylin, you know, historians reinterpret the past for the present all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, he talked about that, you know, different when he was criticized for not including enough women and Native Americans, for example, he basically said like, yeah, like that's right. But you know, different historians will include them. Hopefully. So I get the spirit of that. As someone who's lived in many different parts of America, there are some people I think need to be reminded of the beauty of American history. And there are some people I think need to be more reminded of the terribleness in American history. And the challenge I'm finding is how do you get those different people to pay attention to the elements you think they're neglecting or underappreciating. Mm-hmm. And the final thing I'll say, this has really stuck with me from Dr. Randall's interview, man, like 2 years ago, that Americans sometimes don't realize how young this country is. And in the history of the world, like that sometimes when we look at our grandeur and our terribleness, we kind of don't realize that we're not even 500 years old. Like, yeah, it's when you look at like the nations of Europe who can trace everything from, you know, the Roman Empire to Napoleon Bonaparte and everything in between, you know, it can be difficult to appreciate how small American history is. I know I'm kind of meandering all over the place. Mm-hmm. But if I could use, you know, one political pundit who I quite like, he said, you may not want to bet on America, but I wouldn't bet against America. So I kind of take that to heart.
Well, that sounds good. You know, it's funny that you mentioned that, you know, we do have a very short history comparatively. I have a friend from Liverpool who says that his favorite pub is older than our country. It's one of those things. Okay, well, this has really been a fascinating conversation. You know, I love speaking to other podcasters, meeting of the minds about what we're doing kind of in our would you call this a, dare I say, a hobby? I don't know if I would classify, maybe. It's something that it's a labor of love. How about that?
Yeah, service to the profession.
I think that's so much better. Yes, that's much better.
That's on my CV. I think in the service to the profession or digital humanities or something. I'm not sure.
Service to the profession is nice, though. I think I'm going to stick with
it. Yeah, yeah. It makes it grandiose.
Mm-hmm, very much so. All right. Well, then thanks again for coming on. Where do we find you on the internet for those of us looking?
So you can find me, I'm on Twitter at Daniel Gullotta, Gullotta. You can also find me on Instagram if you're interested in menswear. You can see me debating menswear choices and things there. I also do that on Twitter. I actually talk more about menswear on Twitter than I do history sometimes. That'll get it, you know, I get into more Star Wars fights on Twitter than I do history fights often. I also write infrequently at The Bulwark. So you can usually find my opinion columns there. And if you want to reach out to me, if you go to Stanford's portfolio, you can send me an email there.
Okay. Well, Daniel, thanks a lot for coming on the show. It's been great talking to you.
Thank you very much for having me. Stay rogue.
Yes, indeed, sir.
So let me take a sec to tell you all about an exciting project I've got going on at Keith Harris History. I've transcribed and podcasted a series of letters written by Confederate prisoner of war Henry A. Allen. Allen was an officer in the 9th Virginia Infantry who was captured at Gettysburg at the Bloody Angle, the culmination of the Pickett-Pettigrew assault on July 3, 1863. He served in various prisoner of war camps for the duration of the war. During this time, he wrote often to his wife Sarah, back in Portsmouth, Virginia, discussing the day-to-day life in Union prisons and his many thoughts on the war, his marriage and children, and life as a prisoner. I am currently annotating these letters to fill in the missing information and provide links to useful resources concerning Allen in particular and the prisoner of war experience in general. This is an ongoing process where I'll be adding new information and revising my commentary as my research on the topic develops. So please go to keithharrishistory.com, click on the podcast tab, and have a listen to the Civil War letters of Henry A. Allen. From there, you can explore all kinds of resources and book suggestions that will help enrich your understanding of Union prisons and Confederate prisoners.